What are your qualifications?
Well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively.
I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people.
You just don't know when to give up, do you?
I could do this all day.
The Matt Sodnikar Podcast.
Tech episodes of this podcast are now supported by Furos.io. That is Furos.io. Furos is a Denver cloud consulting firm, and chances are if there's a big building in downtown Denver with their logo on the outside of it, Furos has got people in there doing some very interesting work that has an impact on those businesses. They focus on AWS, cloud, consulting, and their mantra is simple. Hire the best people they can, pay them really well, and let them work on challenging, interesting projects that have impacts on the business. So if you are struggling with the cloud, and I know that's a really overused word in the tech space, and projects aren't getting done, and you need some help, look them up, furos.io. That is F-U-R-O-S.io. Welcome to the podcast. This is Matt Sodnikar. I'm sitting here with my friend Sharon Allpress. She works at DCP Midstream. She's a product manager, a cyclist, and we just determined a very curious individual because I asked her what gets her out of bed in the morning, and that's where we landed. And so, Sharon, thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. One of the things I'll tell you, I alluded to the story before we started recording, you work for a midstream oil and gas company.
Yes.
And I think 5 or 6 years ago when I was in a business that sold to oil and gas companies, I was at a networking function. I talked to this guy. I said, oh, yeah, we're in oil and gas. And he goes, oh, really? What part? And I just went totally blank. And he's like, son, get it. Pats me on the head. He's like, okay, so upstream, like we drill, right? We get the stuff out of the ground. Midstream, we move it from the well to wherever. And then downstream is like retail. So it's like, when you say you're in oil and gas, it's like kind of saying like you're from planet Earth.
Right.
So I never forgot that. And that's what I learned from him. So I was trying to be all smart, and then I got exposed pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's, on the outside, it seems pretty simple, but once you start peeling back the layers of even just the midstream industry, it's very complex. And that's something that really is super interesting as far as building products, because you think it's a pretty simple solution, and then you start getting into it, and you're like, whoa, there's a lot here to digest and to understand. And I've been in it just over a year in the midstream side. And every single day, I think there's something else I learn with the business and the industry.
Where were you before this?
I was at some startups.
Oh, okay.
Some SaaS-based startups. Again, and just big data, lots of data and analytics. And my first startup, I was at, we were doing similar work for energy industry with kind of industrial IoT sensors and bringing in time series streaming data on sensors out on equipment in the field. And so this is my role right now. I've been able to use a lot of my knowledge from there, from that role. However, I am going much, much deeper into the engineering and the science and the economics of midstream.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's been a big learning curve.
Was there one particular, not shock, but surprise coming from even like the IoT space of the SaaS platforms to midstream that was just like, that just was like an eye-opening doors blown off moment?
I think it was mostly from the business model side.
Okay.
And that was that we service customers at both ends of our business.
Oh.
Which kind of blew my mind from a business model financial standpoint. So we process the gas that the producers, the drillers, get out of the ground. But then we have the commodity market that we then sell to once we've processed the gas. So there's this balance that it's like a two-headed system,
right?
That financial system that we always have to keep in mind when we talk about like all of our logistics and decisions. And yeah, it's interesting that way. And so it's like you're not just selling to someone, you're paying both ends of the system with two different customer sets.
Okay. So as a midstream company, you don't drill, right?
No.
But you're buying what's been drilled.
Yeah.
And then that moves, and then you sell that to somebody else.
We move and process it, and sell the products to someone else. So to the commodity markets.
Okay.
Yeah. So we sell it out. You know, we sell the liquids, and then we sell the gases out to those markets, which can be energy companies, or it can be, you know, chemical companies that they use as feed into chemical processes, plastics, you know, lots of different stuff.
Okay.
So I've had to learn, I had to dig out my chemistry. We've got ethane process, we've got methane, we've got the heavy, you know, heavy chemicals, light chemicals, moving it from gas to a liquid when you pressure it up, but then some of the, and I got to make sure I get it right, some of the heavier molecules drop down to liquids, depending on the temperature and the pressures. And
is that Boyle's Law?
I don't know. I'll say yes. Sounds good.
I will look it up, because as you're talking about that, I'm flashing back to my.
Yeah, I can't remember if that's physics. Like Chem 1 or Chem 2 or physics. That all just merges together. I can't remember.
Well, I got a D in physics, so I'll have to go back and look. So.
Yeah, I was challenged in chemistry. Physics was like easy. I could see it happening. Chemistry, I'm like, I got to balance these molecules and I can't even see them. I can't hold them. How do you know that's really happening? Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. But yeah. So.
Yeah. So what was I saying?
About the chemistry.
Yeah. So there's a lot to it. So we move the gas. So I think it's something that people are not necessarily aware of, is that we also process it into, it's kind of, think of it as this first layer of products that then end up as consumables or as gas that you use as propane to heat your house or what have you. Yeah. Plastics and feed into, other chemicals that we use day to day.
My buddy works for IES combustors, and so he took me through the separators that divert all that stuff, and talking about pressures and, you know, all the the safety regulations and the manufacturing, and I've seen the welding plants and all that, and it's fascinating, just the pressures they're dealing with and the volumes. It's amazing stuff.
Yeah, it's also very hazardous, and something that DCP has been really good at is reliability and safety. You know, particularly on the safety side, because we're dealing with such high, you know, combustible gases, you've got to be really, really, really careful.
Yeah.
So that's kind of our number one driver. It's just people safety.
Right. And you said you're a product manager. So are you? What product are you designing here? And again, not confidential, top secret stuff, but is it the oil products, the gas products? Are you like designing something that's a thing that goes and does something else?
Yeah, it's not that cool. It is kind of cool though. It's just, it's software.
Okay.
It's software. I wish it was hardware, but that's really complex.
Software product
manager. So software, software product manager, which is a little bit surprising probably for people to think about a midstream, you know, oil and gas company building software. You don't hear that very often, but we're doing it. We're doing it. And my product is, the way I explain it is making sense of data. Is my product to help us, you know, to help the business make the best decision as far as processing and operating assets in the field and the gas.
Okay.
Yeah, and the best decision from an operational volumetric point of view, and also the best decision from a financial point of view as well for our producers and for our stakeholders.
All right. That's making a lot more sense to me now. So I had interviewed Dr. Phil Beaver from DU, who I'll introduce you to. So he's the professor of analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what he said. It's just making sense of the data and making better decisions.
Yep.
And the thing that he taught me was that what question do you want to ask your data?
Yeah. And you can flip it around. What problems are you trying to solve?
Sure.
And out of that comes the question.
Okay.
Yep.
So what questions do you ask your data?
Where are you? No. So I think just to start with, just to think about the scope and size of DCP processing, like our gathering and processing system, looking at from a data perspective, you know, we bring in 7 billion data points a day from our sensors in the field.
Wow.
Yeah. And what do you do with that? Like from an operation standpoint, right, you're looking at all of this data, you're looking at these screens with data flipping over every 10 seconds. Where am I supposed to look? What am I supposed to focus on? You know, you can't focus on everything. And what am I missing? Because I'm focusing on something over here. What am I missing over there that really needs my attention? So the first thing we did is trying to think, okay, well, let's figure out what is the most important thing people in the office and in the field should be looking at and focusing on in their day-to-day work. So again, what problems are you trying to solve? What questions are you asking? And we went into looking at that and seeing, okay, well, what is our normal operating conditions? At this particular, I mean, to keep it really simple, at this particular plant, what inlet volumes should we expect to see? And if it goes below or sometimes above a certain volume, let me know. I mean, it's as simple as that, and then it can be as complex as that, right? Because it gets, there's a lot of details and nuances to that. But pretty much what we stood up was, it's really making sense of all that data and standing up, a system that I call it our health, the health of a system, right? It's just, I wanted to look at, you know, where are we sick? Where are we doing well at any given time? And creating visibility across the organization. So everyone, at any place, anywhere, anytime within DCP knows the health of our system. And that's where we started about a year ago. And yeah, we've evolved it from there. And we have, you know, groups. We started with 12 users in this integrated collaboration center that we have in corporate here in Denver that collaborates and works with operations in the field and at plants to help improve, you know, to try and troubleshoot and try to maximize, you know, our processing and our financials and our volumes through the plants. And we started off with those 12 users, and now it's grown to, you know, almost everyone at DCP is using this in some way or another. I mean, we even have our commercial team using it and looking at our field operations to make sure that the producers that they represent, you know, are that their gas is able to flow in the system, and they can help really manage that relationship.
So I used to be a software engineer, and as you were describing that, I wasn't drifting off because I was bored. I was drifting off because I was thinking that, because I used to do medical device software, so I was processing inputs and error signals, and then I'm still trying to get my head around 7 billion data points because I'm used to like 15 IO things and kind of looking at conditions and that sort of stuff. And then I guess my question is that it's the same data, and I think you mentioned this before, but if you're in finance or other different spots, that parts of that data mean different things to different people.
Yes.
Okay. So yes, you have to have a really good understanding of the business.
Yes.
And help them not ask, I was going to say dumb questions, but perhaps uninformed questions of the data.
Yes. You have to be very specific in the data that you're presenting. Okay. And for me, what's important to me, I think maybe it comes from my schooling and background. We're talking about chemistry and the sciences, is that data is, people have to understand the data and where it comes from and the assumptions that are made, particularly in the analytics. So it's really important that we include information about how something was calculated, what are the sources of that data, of that calculation, so people can make better informed decisions on that data. And it's because, yeah, you can think that the inputs into a calculation is from A, B, and C, but actually it was from 4 days ago. And that's going to completely change how you use that information.
Sure. Because, I think you need good data and good questions.
Yeah. And then it's also understanding what is what is the data that moves the needle? Because something that have found is that we want all available data. People tend to want to have all available data just in case.
Just in case. Yeah.
Just in case I might need it. And so that starts to kind of cloud your decision making. So it's asking the questions, and you hear it often these days, it's the five whys, right? To really narrow down, well, what are the critical pieces of data that helps you make that decision, that you need to make that decision? And what are the other pieces of data that maybe inform things that we could have off at the side that you could access if you need to? But we want to make it really crisp and clean as to these are the data, three data points that you need to be monitoring and looking at every single day.
So this might be kind of an odd question, but when looking at the data, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Ooh. I would add a third.
Okay.
I'm a realist.
Okay.
Because if you understand where the data comes from, you understand what assumptions or what story is trying to be told with the data. And you can figure out if it's a real story or if it's a fake story. And so then that helps keep you objective, I think, with data. Yeah. If that makes
Interesting.
Sense.
Interesting. Because I'm just picturing like the Hollywood trope, right? Where you've got this data and like alarm bells going off. And, I'm just curious if you look at, and it's probably just over dramatized, but are there situations like that where it doesn't add up, where kind of what you're seeing, I get like an extreme case or like an outlier, has that ever happened? I guess that's where I'm trying to go with this question, is like, has there been something? That's why I kind of asked, when you're looking at data, if you have to be, if it has to be proven right or proven wrong. That was a long, boring question. I'm sorry. That was clumsy, but
no, it's interesting. That's really interesting. So to answer that, we had some stuff come up, it's some of data, like data is living, breathing, moving all the time. So particularly in an analytics system, there's hiccups in the system. There's things happen and your data goes bad in your application. Because there's a lot of back end calculations and processes and things. And so that something happened yesterday or a couple days ago. And we had myself and the team got together and we did a kind of an RCA, kind of a root cause analysis, kind of retro on what happened. And one of the things we were talking about was when I've been in data my entire career in one way or another. From college on now. It's just been a different type of data. And I've learned that when I look at data, I look at it, I need to be proven right. So I look at data and I assume it's wrong.
Okay.
So maybe to answer your question earlier is that I'm a pessimist. Because I assume it's wrong until I can prove to myself that it is accurate and right. And that's not just in my job, it's in everything. Like I read the news or anything, I'm like, well, I don't believe it until I can understand what's.
So it's proving the hypothesis. Or do you even start with the hypothesis? And do you let the data move you and take you where it's gonna go and then you validate?
No, I don't let the data do that.
Okay.
You get lost then, and then it can prove you wrong. Like, you start with your hypothesis. Yeah. Yeah, because if you just follow the data, well, who's to say the data is right? You may end up in a really bad decision. Yeah.
So how did you get into data? You said college and your whole career. What led you to that?
Well, I wanted to be a wildlife biologist. And I went to school for that. And then I've always been fascinated with just software and technology and computers since I was little. I had like a Texas Instrument, like little console that you'd plug into your TV.
I did too.
Did you get one of those?
Yeah.
And I wish I still had it. And you had these little cartridges that you'd like slide in and you could play like... It was like the Texas Instrument version of like Donkey Kong and Pac-Man and stuff.
I totally forgot.
Because we never had Atari, so we had that. And then you could program in BASIC.
Yeah.
And so I used to program in our big like tube TV in our living room with like wood panel walls. And I would
program in BASIC. We totally would have been best friends.
That's what I used to do for fun when like middle school.
I did too. Yeah.
And then it was like each like row was like a number. You would like number the line 10, 20, 30, 40. And you'd say go to line 30 and go to line 50 and go back to line 10 to do your.
Yes. And I forgot I had that TI because I did a lot of my stuff on the Commodore 64.
Oh, I never had that. Oh, I wasn't cool like that.
All right, continue. I just flashed back.
Oh, I know. It's so great. Like back to the day before.
Sixth or seventh grade. Yeah.
Yep.
Which led me to my engineering career, which I never.
There we go. It all goes back from the Texas Instruments. Look what they developed, right? People give Apple all the credit. Maybe TI gets some of the credit.
Wow. Anyway, okay, so the program, the TI, and then
so then I took like some we had programming classes in my high school, so it was either take typing or take computer programming, which I can't remember. Maybe it wasn't BASIC. I can't remember at this point. And I was like, I am not learning how to type on a typewriter, so I took the programming class. And then in college, part of my program, they had like a minor or a center for GIS and remote sensing, which is all the mapping stuff, but really like spatial analysis and image processing of imagery data. And we were using that, they were using that for like natural resources applications. And so I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I like biology, but I kind of want to keep my, I still have an interest in, technology, software, all that stuff. So I I did that as a minor, and then I ended up going to get my master's in GIS and remote sensing, really like kind of geomatics, they call it now, or geospatial science. And then from there, you know, went into the GIS world and to consulting, and worked on a lot of, worked for in the electric utility space. That was in the time where they were moving from paper maps to putting their, all of their outside plant, like the poles, wires, transformers, you know, into a GIS system. And then integrating that with outage management systems, you know, voice response, workforce management, and really transforming the utility distribution industry. I did that for a long time, and I loved it. Like GIS and geospatial sciences is, and again, and that is like huge. That's data, different type of data. It's a lot of connected networks, and so you have to understand connectivity and also understand electrical modeling and how you model electricity from, we would take it from the substation down to the home. So it wasn't a high velocity data, but it was very complex data sets that you had to work with. And then also working with unversioning and doing as-builts and lots of different stuff that at that time, it was really leading edge at that time. And you know, 10 years into it, I just kind of started to get a little bit bored of, you know, same technology, same stuff. And then the kind of the SaaS world started to really kind of take hold. And I just found that the GIS, it just wasn't moving fast enough for me from a technology standpoint. So I decided to make that jump and move to the startup world and the SaaS. I made a stop in SAP for a while, and I was like, oh, this is, I'm going to jump out of here quickly.
I don't know much about that, but I do know that I don't want to be anywhere near it.
Yeah, talk about an old, old system. And it was really great. I learned a lot, but I learned what I didn't like, which was good too. But yeah, then moving into just the SaaS world and then working into this IoT and high velocity data and analytics, and really the culmination of like bringing together, you know, doing the, like the image processing, that a lot of that stuff that we were doing, that was some of the basics and fundamentals of what we do today and what we call machine learning. We just called it classifications back then. But now the same algorithms, all that same stuff is being used today in machine learning. It's pretty much the same thing. It just today it's more accessible to people, to everyone. The processing power of computers are so much cheaper. Like the machines that we were on were like Unix systems, and they were $20,000 a workstation. Well, that's, you know, out of the hands of a lot of people back then. And there just wasn't the big data back then, because we didn't digitize a lot of stuff. And then over the last 15, 20 years, we've digitized, and then we have social media and all of that, where we just have, you know, everything is digital now. So we have a much bigger data sets that we can run machine learning on. So it's that evolution there. And so I just really wanted to, you know, be in a place where I could use all of that background and knowledge and statistics and analytics. And then also, you know, from an asset intensive industry, like being from the electrical world, I'm learning a lot I've had a lot to learn in midstream, but there's a lot of stuff that is directly transferable from the electric, just from an asset intensive sort of business, and what that entails. So that's a really, really long explanation of how I got into
No, I loved it.
into data. Yeah.
So you had mentioned low velocity data and high velocity data.
Yeah.
What determines, is it like the, I'm going to get the wrong terminology, but is like the volume or is it the speed at which it's sampled? Like what determines?
Yeah, probably how you would classify
that? Okay.
Both. Yeah. The volume and the velocity. velocities, the speed with which it comes in. Like some of our sensors bring in every 10 seconds, some bring it in every 2 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, if you look back on like the GIS data that I was working in with electric utility, a lot of that was like, it was asset data. It was a pole is out there and a line goes, you know, and you have transformers connected to it. Well, that transformer is going to be connected to it for 20 years. So that transformer is not going to change. The information, the data you get from like the SCADA system out of that transformer, obviously that is coming in really fast. But it really hasn't been till the last, I don't know, 5-10 years that we've really had the technology to be able to process and do things with that streaming high velocity data. It's made it, well, we've been able to do it. It's just cheaper to do it now.
Okay.
With, you know, with all the cloud platforms out there, with Azure, AWS and Google Analytics, it makes the processing, you don't have to buy the hardware. So hardware used to be, you know, it still is expensive to maintain and manage. And,
sure. So how big of a footprint every day does that 7 billion data points, like, would that fit on like a thumb drive? Like how big is that footprint for the data? When you're saying 7 billion, I mean,
numbers. You know, I've never
gig just right there, right? 7 billion.
Yeah, so that's, see, I'm not a hardware person. I don't know if that, then transferring into that. Yeah, that's, I'll let you do the math.
Yeah,
somebody has asked me that recently, and I could not answer it. And I've been meaning to run to figure that out, but I don't know.
Well, if it was 7 billion ones and zeros, individual characters, then that's 7 gig, right? But you're probably not, they're not all single digits. So it's got to be more than that.
Yeah, no, it's more than, yeah. It's, they're all the data points are going to be between 7 and 10 digits each. How's that? You want to run some math quickly? Let's see it.
No, I'm already getting a headache. It's big. It's
big, you know. It's half a million sensors. So we have half a million sensors coming in at different streams, and honestly, that does not include all of our sensors. That number does not include all of our sensors from the meters that we have at the wellheads. So we have 40,000 more, between about 45,000 wellheads. So there's a whole bunch of data coming in from that as well that we are starting to look into bringing into the system. So it's a lot.
But the
possibilities are just, you know, like really endless. And some of the, we're just doing really, really cool stuff. Like we're just starting to get into, you know, trying to figure out. One is mashing up the financial picture with the volume streaming data and all of what that looks like in the field, right? So if we have an upset, what does that cost? You know, and if we have an upset, who's impacted? And so it's going to lead us down the road of being able to service our producers faster because we know who is impacted, so we can inform them faster, but also we can respond to upsets in the field faster and reduce our downtime, so thereby increasing our reliability. And that's something that all this data is allowing us to get to. And in our system, we have optionality. So if we do have an upset, where can we move that gas? To keep the system flowing, so we don't have to shut in. And so what I love about it is it brings me back to my GIS days. Even though we don't have this today in the GIS, I still think about it as a connected network. And you know, looking from the electric distribution side, everything was connected. They were all connected networks, and we could model out if we have an outage here, or if we have a bunch of customers who have called in, we could model upstream of where the likely point is where the outage occurred. Like, you probably get the text from Excel too, like, hey, we have an outage and ETA to resolution is this. Well, they know from where the outage is, they know, they can algorithmically tell from the connected network all of the customers that are impacted. So then they shoot out a text to you and say, hey, you know, even though you haven't called in, they know that you're out. And so that's something that we're looking, you know, we're moving towards in what we're doing, because we have optionality. You know, like in the utility network, you can open and close switches to route and reroute electricity. Well, we can do the same thing. So we can, knowing that, knowing what our system constraints are, and knowing what volumes we're currently flowing and what our capacity is, well, what's our availability and what can we move where? And then the next piece of that is, we talked about the two-sided financial. So we have commodity markets coming out of each plant and they're different. So you can say, so I say mashing up the financial data, well, when I move my gas to another plant, the financial picture looks completely different at that plant. And what does moving the gas to that plant, what's that financial picture look like? So we can really start looking at, not just looking at us operating our business from a volume standpoint, but also from an economic and financial standpoint.
This is really cool.
Yeah, we're doing really cool stuff.
I really like this.
I mean, it's hard work.
Oh, I bet.
Hard work. But it's really, like, and what I love about it, like I was saying, is like it brings in a lot of what I was doing for the electric world and bringing it into thinking about it from solving midstream problems.
Yeah, it sounds like you found a perfect fit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's only taken me a whole career.
Yeah.
No, that's
if we
not
had
true.
All the answers, I've been every fun.
Yeah, every step along the way has been I want to say purposeful, but has had its purpose along the journey for sure.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes, and I tell myself this when I'm struggling or searching for an answer, is that when the Voyager is ready, the guide will appear. So perhaps, you know, you talk about, and again, my career path has been that of a butterfly, like all over, up and down, and like, what the hell's going on? But, you know,
yeah.
I wasn't ready for whatever it was at that particular time until that moment. So
right.
The important thing is you're here now.
I'm here now. And what's interesting is along that path, I didn't, at the time, I didn't really have a plan. But I look back now and I realize that there's been a common theme through everything I've worked. And it's always been about the data and the information and making sense of data into information.
Have you ever taken a DISC profile?
No.
Okay.
What is that?
Well, Myers-Briggs, you've heard of Myers-Briggs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've done that, and then like the Enneagram thing.
Okay.
And then I've also done, there's one other one, I can't remember what it's called.
Because where I'm going with this question is, with a very data-heavy job and like a brilliant data mind, I'm curious how much of that transfers over to like your personal life. Like, and not, I'm not trying to ask a very personal question, but are you that segmented and analytical, and I mean that as a compliment, in your personal life?
No.
Okay.
No. I am that butterfly.
All right. All right.
I want to be. I wish I aspire to be, but I think my brain just needs a break. When I go home and I'm just last minute kind of, what do I feel like dinner tonight? Oh, this, that. Like, yeah, okay. I'm much less analytical in that life. Like even with cycling, right?
Yes.
So we're all cyclists,
yes.
And riding bikes and like training with power and all that stuff. Like the only reason I ever train with power is to give my power files to my coach and be like, here, you figure it out and you tell me what to do. Like, did I ever track my TSS score? I would kind of look at it and just for.
I don't know what that is.
It's like, it's your stress, your training stress score.
Okay.
So it gets calculated based on the power that based on the level of effort for each workout. And so then it compounds day after day if you've done lots of like hard effort. I don't look at any of that. And then there's days I just take my power meter, my head unit off. I would never ever race with a power unit on, or I'd put duct tape over it so I couldn't see the numbers. Like I didn't want to know. I don't want to know. Yeah.
Well, it's binary, right? I don't have any, a friend of mine gave me a Garmin watch, which I will just set because I'm just curious more about like elevation on certain rides, but I don't care about speed and I'm not one of these Strava dorks, you know?
Yeah.
But years ago, I took the head unit off my road bike because I was at the Santa Fe Century and you saw me struggling to do the math with like the 10 digit numbers versus 7 billion. I was really having a terrible day on the bike and I was like at mile 36 out of 100 and I was going maybe 6 miles an hour and my math was like, I'm gonna be out here for like 12 more hours, right?
So I better turn around now.
I was like, I took that thing off and I stuffed it in my pocket.
That's the thing, you play head games, like your mind starts playing these games with the numbers
and racing, right? It's binary, either you're fast enough to be with the pack.
Right.
Or you're not.
Who cares what the number says? You're either there or you're not.
Yeah. If you're screwed, you're screwed. Right. I don't want to know how bad.
It
doesn't help.
I don't want to know how much it hurts. No.
Good. So yeah, we would be good riding buddies too. So, because I don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah. Even when I was like racing and training, I didn't care about it. I just couldn't. I don't know. It's interesting. That's a very interesting question. Yeah, I'm not that analytical. I think I do. I probably process like subconsciously when I make decisions. I do, but do I have like spreadsheets and stuff like no?
Well, for years I went with undiagnosed ADHD until I was like mid-30s maybe. And I realized that a lot of my compensatory behaviors were from my adaptability and lack of organization.
Oh.
And that's why I was a terrible engineer, is that I would visualize the problem and I still do that. Like if you were talking, like even as you were talking about some of your processes, I'm trying to write workflows, just like that's naturally what I do. But the minute that it's done, like if we've whiteboarded it, I don't want anything to do with it after that. Like I would be a good like skunk works person or design person.
Yeah.
But
like
the ideation
piece.
Yes.
Yes.
And the implementation and the iteration. That's what drove me out of software I worked for a medical device company, which has probably just as stringent regulations as oil and gas does. And it was like, I remember like version 1.23 of this subroutine. And I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
I don't want to look at this again.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you say that, because you just triggered a memory, a recollection of me, or just a memory or a point. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Is that one of the things that took me from like the GIS world, the kind of the into like the SAS based, was that like version numbers, the one dot, and like you, all that effort you would do to like release an executable installed like piece of software and then press and put it out in the DVDs. I was like, oh my gosh, just the monotony of this. And it wasn't moving fast enough.
Yes.
And what I loved about what I was learning about SAS Pass, all those sorts of platforms. It's just the continuous integration that you can do into live living software. Like, we can release multiple times a day and bring value to our users right away. As soon as that feature, that small little feature's done, boom, it's out.
Yeah.
Like, people are using it. And that's the part of the what I really wanted to move to as well. I mean, not just in the data side, but really that more modern way of delivering features to users. Because I get bored. Like that, that ideation thing, like, we need to be working on new stuff. Otherwise my brain, like, the same with you, I'm like, oh my gosh, just, I lose focus. The monotony.
Totally. Well, and I asked that question because, and I'll send you a link for the disc profile, just because, yeah, I think it'd be fascinating, because I don't want to influence that in any way. And it's just been, I used to teach it, I used to sell it, and it's just, it's all behaviors, right?
Okay.
But the behaviors that I have tried, that I would rail against, would be like organization and planning and, again, managing the ADD and that stuff. Like, I realize I'm going to pay a time penalty. Like, I hate looking for stuff more than I hate getting organized.
But you hate looking for stuff more than you hate getting organized.
Yes. So I have to pay a time penalty one way or the other.
So does that mean you get organized?
As much as I can tolerate.
Yeah.
MVO, minimum viable organization.
Oh, nice.
MVO. And I just coined that right now.
I like it. You should trademark it, register it, all that stuff.
We'll share the trademark.
We can we'll spin up a parallel Marie Kondo.
Yes, I was just going to say that. for people that are too busy to get organized. But yeah, and then again, coming at it from like the recovering analytics side, like, I'll see if I'm looking for something, that means I need it immediately. So it's typically going out the door, like, can't find something or like whatever. Yes. Whereas if I put it away, I don't need it, and then there's peace and calm on that end of it.
Yes.
And I don't mind being challenged and stressed for the right reasons, but for my car keys or for my helmet, I try to avoid that. So
that's wise.
Try. Those are huge air quotes around that. I try to do it at the front end.
That's so wise.
Not at the back end.
I had a crisis this weekend with car keys because I did not organize, and I lost both sets. Oh. And I'm on the phone with the car dealer. How long does it take to get a new key?
Were you at home?
I was at home. Okay. The car was in the garage. Oh. It was like 5 o'clock, or no, it was like 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And I'm like, oh, can I use Uber for the rest of my weekend until the dealership opens?
I've done that. And so the logical path I go through is that I drove home. So the keys,
yes,
are here.
The keys
somewhere.
Are here somewhere.
By definition.
They have to be
the
here.
The data says the keys are here.
Yes. That's exactly what I went through. They have to be here. Yeah.
And where did you find him?
Well, I found, so I ended up, just leaving the house and like going for a walk or something, because I was just beside myself. And then I came back and I just had an aha moment, and I went straight to the old key that I had lost. So I have two sets. I did not find the one that I was using that day, but I found the key. My brain remembered where I had left the key a few weeks ago, because it was in a jacket that I haven't worn since the weather turned and got warm. So, but the key that I had lost that day that I was using that day is still missing. I need to go on another walk in 2 weeks and I will find that key.
Oh, man. I found a torque wrench and a handlebar light that was in my ski bag that I thought I had lost or it got stolen. And I went outside the norm, and instead of taking like my normal travel suitcase, I took my ski bag and dumped all the crap out of it and took it to a bike event. And so I was looking for that headlight for a night ride. I was like, and I'd torn the house apart over a couple weeks going, where is this? And then when I went skiing to Pagosa that weekend in February,
oh,
there it is.
Right. And then at that moment, you're like, you know, if I'd only put it back where it lived, I would have saved so much time.
Right.
Right. And then I just keep doing the same thing over and over. I don't know. It's a feature. It's one of my features.
I'm wired the exact same way.
I got to learn how to manage it.
Well, if you figure it out, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, like I was telling when I was setting up this podcast rig, I have a checklist and then that hang tag that's on the handle right there that's dangling down there, it says computer with a question mark because I've left with the suitcase with all the microphones and the headphones and the stands and all that shit.
Yes.
And then in my bag, I'm like, oh no.
Oh no.
So, yeah, the organization has come. I will do the organization after a failure, right?
Yeah, then you flurry. You do this flurry of like, I've got to organize, right? Because you're like, this is bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it goes downhill from there.
But I have trained myself to not get upset. And that was a very, very hard thing to do, where I would just sit and calm down.
Yeah.
And I ask myself, I go, okay, you were trying to be clever, so you outsmarted yourself. Where did you put it?
Right.
So what would be something that the distracted me did that seemed really efficient and clever at the time that was so obscure that you can't remember it now? And then I try to make myself laugh, because to get upset about it, like, I just don't like being upset, period. Yeah. But anyway.
It's easy.
It's not just you.
Okay. I feel better. But yeah, no, you'd think that I would be much more structured at home. Whoa, we just lost the lights.
Oh, stand up.
How you doing on time, by
the way? What time? Oh, I'm good.
Okay. I got about 5 more minutes.
So. Okay.
I definitely want to do a part 2 and dive into like more of the data stuff, because I find that just mind-boggling at this point, just with my conversations with people like you and Phil, just of the volume of stuff that you guys deal with.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, my brain can flip and flop, obviously. I haven't really thought about this, but I look at the data and I look at it, like, if I tried to figure out what, you know, what all we can do with the 7 billion points of data, sitting down at one point in time, like I would get nowhere. So I look at it like a, an evolution, like a data evolution for, and so there's things that we just don't know to know until we've uncovered layer 2. And then we illuminate and uncover and learn about things. And then we can then continue on the journey to layer 3 and layer 4 of the analytics and the data that we're, and the questions that we're trying to answer. And if we're trying to, and like the thoughts about it, trying to answer some of our financial, bringing in the financial data, or then also looking at, you know, where's our, like, and a question is, where's our missing gas? Gas has come onto the system, didn't show up at the plants. Where is it? Where'd it go?
Oh.
Right. So that's another question. And if we were trying to solve for that a year ago, we would still be trying to solve for that and have gotten nowhere, because that's such a big thing. But you take the little pieces on that journey and you get there. eventually. But there's so much information in the data that you can get lost in it very, very easily.
So do you first have to establish normal with your data? So like you said, the missing gas. So do you have to just go, this is like 10% of the average or mean or whatever. And then can you start looking and expanding on that and then having it trip exceptions? Is that just an approach?
Yeah, I mean, it's an approach that we're at the point now where we know our gas is, we know we have gas missing. So we're able to track that, you know, volumetrically. The next question is, well, where is it missing? Like, from what part of the system is it missing from? You know, do we have a leak somewhere? Are we inefficient at some booster stations? Like, what's going on? And so we're trying to answer those questions. And so we're moving into that world. Along with trying to figure out how we can move the gas in the network if we have an upset. So there's a lot of components. And so now really from a digital software standpoint, like a DCP, you know, we've invested heavily in cloud technologies and data lakes and things like that. So we've had a big effort in bringing in all the data from our enterprise systems into this data lake so we could start using it, using data from all across the business rather than simply our IIoT data. And so that is just kind of, it's really helping us kind of bring to light and bring in to answer more of these higher order questions that we're trying to solve.
So so it makes a ton of sense that you can switch the data mined off and on, because at the lowest, data is the lowest level.
Mm-hmm.
But then to the higher order questions, the term you just used, that has to be so abstract.
So abstract.
It can't be connected by definition to anything that low level.
No, because we've never, it just hasn't been done before. Like, we're asking questions that, and brainstorming solutions that there's no algorithm for. There's no paper out there that we can go and reference to say, well, how? And we literally, like, I partner with the business. Like, the business, they, right. Like, I cannot be successful without the business, because they give me context and they understand the nuances. Like I was saying, the complexity of processing and moving gas. So they help me tremendously make sense of the data. And then it really is a creative process. You know,
yeah.
I've been doing it in the last week. I was in Houston last week and working with some folks with a commercial team, trying to figure out how do we track some of this missing gas and how do we solve that? And then looking at, well, what are our, you know, we just call it baby steps. You know, we look at our future, right? And this is what we want to do. And then we go, oh, well, there's no way we can do that today. Okay, well, what do we have to do first, second, third? And it's really breaking it down to its most elemental components as you go. But you can't be so structured, because then you don't open up the room for and the breathing space for that creativity in trying to solve these problems. And then also trying to solve them really simply. The more complex your solution is, the more likely you're going to be wrong. And the more likely you're going to introduce error. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of that abstract thinking around it as well.
It sounds like you have an amazing job.
It's fun. Yeah.
You should get a raise.
I'll connect you to my boss.
Okay.
That would be nice.
I'll do what I can. Yeah, I definitely want to do another conversation because this is fascinating, and just meeting another brain a lot like mine is I don't feel so alone in the universe. So well, thank you.
I'm glad we could inhabit the same planet in the universe.
Me too. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah. It's been fun chatting.
Cool.
About all this stuff. Yeah.
Thank you, Sharon. We'll see you soon.
Sounds great. Next time.